That's enough, people. We are missing somebody, though, right?
Yeah, I'm missing.
I think Chad sometimes comes. He sent me an email. I think, no, he said he was leaving early, not arriving late. Let me think. I turned over 9. I lost track. Count heads. Let's see. Yeah. If you all move fast enough, it'll look like there are enough people. Let's
start it. I don't have the book yet.
And I got online to try to figure out exactly, what we should be doing to move along with the book, which is what I'd like to be doing. And Amazon said, well, you've seen enough pages. I'm not going to let you see any more pages. I would have had to shut down and open it back up again. I can look at a few pages at a time of the book, but then I ran into another issue that is often the case with especially introductory field theory books. There are some mathematical points that are handled a bit cavalierly. It works. The things that people are doing work. But it's not always really clear that you can do it that way, and then you wrestle with it and have to think it through. And one of the places where this happens is the next thing that I'm seeing in what's our author's name? Maggiore's book. How many of you have gotten the book?
So,
I
got it tomorrow. A couple copies, you're getting
that
tomorrow? Great. I think it's coming in the mail.
Okay, good. I'm hoping mine's going to show up soon. Fairly has ordered me one, and, I expect it'll turn up. So, we'll lock into the book pretty quickly. Try and share the books that we have and read. Up the first, 20 or 30 pages of what we'll cover pretty soon. I want to keep talking about the Lorentz group. And the reason we're focusing so much right now on the Lorentz group is because we want to do field theory. We want to do a relativistic theory, and we're going to quantize it. Well, quantizing is the procedure that you do after you've got the field theory. So the first question is, what fields do we want to quantize? And, basically, well, all of them, right? So that raises the question, what kinds of fields are there? There are scalar fields. There are vector fields. There are spinner fields. Tensor fields. So... more or less all ranks of tensors, including half-integer ranks, if you think of spinners as those things. And so the reason we need to pay close attention to the Lorentz group is because the fields have to transform tensorially under the Lorentz group, right? The fields that we're going to consider are the Lorentz tensors. And those will include scalar, spinner, vector. I don't think we'll do spin three halves, but could. Gravity is spin two. We want to think about those all as possible things that we might try to quantize. And the most important cases are spin one half and spin one. So we have to know what we mean by that. We know what we mean by spin one half when we're talking about quantum mechanics, because there, you tell me, what do I mean by spin one half in quantum mechanics? What are those spinners? Where do they come from?
Why do
electrons?
Yeah, okay, spin up, spin down. So you've got a little complex two vector. Where did you get a complex two vector? Mathematically, where did it come from?
It's a representation of SO3.
It's a representation of almost.
Well,
SO3 is the rotation group. It's a representation of the rotation group, not of SO3. The covering group of SO3 is SU2. We looked at SU2 last time. SU2 is comprised of 2x2 matrices, and it acts on a complex two-dimensional space. So the space that the covering representation of the rotation group acts on, that's called the representation, it's the space of spinners. Did you get all that?
Yes.
Let's write that one out. Okay, so the...
What did I say?
The space.
The SU2 axon is the space of spinners.
Of two component complex vectors. That's SU2 axon. It's the space of spinners. Of missing phrase here, spinners. Okay, what's the missing phrase? Three D rotation group. Okay, the spinners is a three-dimensional rotation group. The spinners, the relevant spinners depend on what the group is. So we have some set of transformations. Well, we're interested in rotation. Okay, in quantum mechanics, the symmetry of space, if you wanted to build Euclidean three space of the gauge theory, you'd have SO3 in there somewhere. If you're thinking of quotient of something by SO3. The rotation group is the group that acts on vectors in Euclidean three space. So SO3 acts on real three vectors in Euclidean free space. And it maps them into other vectors in Euclidean free space. It's a quirk of mathematics that none of the orthogonal groups is a cover group. None of them is the most fundamental way to represent those symmetries. Okay, all orthogonal groups, SON, SOPQ, if you've got some minus signs in the metric, all of them are rotations or pseudo-rotations of n-dimensional vectors, real n-dimensional vectors. The Lorentz group, SO31, rotates real four vectors. They're pseudo vectors because there's a minus sign in the norm, but it's a pseudo rotation of some four dimensional real vectors. In every one of these orthogonal cases, we can find another group that acts on a complex vector space of some other dimension that is the covering group, that in fact includes, in every case, twice as many transformations. So it turns out that associated with every orthogonal group, there is another group that has two to one, twice the number of transformations. So it can reproduce all of the orthogonal transformations, but it acts on a different space, a complex space. What happens is that these real free vectors are actually a matrix in in a two-dimensional complex space. Yeah, C2. This is always the case. All right. If you've got real n-dimensional vectors, you can always write that as a symmetric matrix in some complex space. And the rotations in that complex space are more fundamental, and they act on these real vectors bilinearly, right? The way you transform a matrix, right? This is this X we've been talking about, right? This one, a three-dimensional example. The way you transform a matrix is by similarity transformation. So our new X is the old X with two transformation matrices. This is where the two-to-one map comes from. And we can always do this. You can always take a real n vector and write it as a complex matrix, some special matrix in some complex vector space. So you'll find there are more transformations because you can see A and minus A. A also acts on a spinner to give some new spinner, but here A and minus A do different transformations, but A and minus A produce the same effect on the real 3 vector because it transforms as a rank 2 tensor, a matrix. Right. That's where the 2-to-1 cover comes from. Question. Ask some questions. How are we doing?
I actually want to know why the similarity transformations work in the first place.
Similarity transformations are what they are. It comes from vector equations. If you have some matrix acting on a vector giving another vector, and you want to transform V to get some V prime, and you're going to transform W to get some W prime, like this. This is a matrix acting on a vector. Then, what happens to M? Well, put this all together, you act with T on M, V, and get T, W is W prime. And if you insert an identity here, you get T, M, V inverse, T, V equals W prime. So the thing that acts on V prime to give W prime is a similarity transformation of your original matrix. So this is what you want to call M prime.
Okay.
That's where it comes from. Now, another answer to the same question, where does the similarity transformation come from? It comes from the laws of tensor analysis. Okay, if... it depends what kind of object this is, in fact. This could be a dagger or a transpose. If this is a covariant or doubly contravariant vector, then you're just going to want a transpose here, or an adjoint. If it's a mixed tensor, you want an A inverse. So it comes from the space of tensors. So we've got a tensor and it's got some up and some down indices, right? And we have a space in the dual space. So if we're going to transform this, we're going to have some lambda, EA through lambda FB. And then we'll have lambda inverses for the down ones. It will be CG through lambda inverse GH to give T prime E, F, G, H. Right? So it goes back to, in this sense, it goes back to the fact that, okay, the spaces tensors are the things that transform linearly or multilinearly and homogeneously under the action of the transformation. And we always have a dual space on a manifold, any manifold. You can define vectors and form. Right? You always have these two independent vector spaces associated with a manifold. So, let's see. This is strayed a lot from field theory. I'm alluding a lot to stuff we talked about in the gauge theory class last spring. So some of you, this will sound a little familiar, and to some of you, I could be talking in Greek up here. Apologies, but I think that will key into what we talked about last spring.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, the tensors for any transformation group are the things that transform linearly and homogeneously. You can have tensors with any number of indices, and you can have up indices and down indices because you're referring to these two different vector spaces that you can associate with the manifold. And those transform oppositely. One transforms under the transformation lambda, the other transforms under the inverse transformation lambda bar. And so for a mixed object, a mixed tensor type, I'm not sure what that actually is. So I'm not sure what we should be doing here. I'm betting we actually want dagger for X. You see, suppose we have a doubly contravariant tensor. So something like this, that's probably what X is. Same position anyway. Then what we want is lambda CA lambda DB. So that would be the transformation. So this would be our M prime CD. Right? But notice, if I bring this one to the other side, this is lambda CA times MAB times lambda BD transpose. If it's a complex space, it'll be the adjoint. So, in this case, it's complex and it's probably doubly co or contravariant. So, we're going to want a dagger here.
Right.
Now, it's funny how many little things like this you never, take the time to sort out, figure out what's really going on. But that's really what's going on. Okay. That was fun. Any other questions? back to the program. We know that for the orthogonal groups, we really want to be looking at this covering representation. We want to look at that complex representation. What's the physical evidence for that? Particles have spin. Right. This 2-to-1 cover is measurable. It's been measured. It's there. So real matter, quarks, leptons are described by fermions. They are described by spinner fields, not vector fields. You can't get quite all the right information into vector fields, but you can in a spinner field. So we know these things exist. So here's the problem. This SU2 was fine when we were talking about quantum mechanics, and the group was SO3, the relevant group preserving the vector space and the vector norm is SO3. Now we're relativistic, and the group is SO31. It's the Lorentz group that preserves the space-time norm for vectors. And so what we really are going to need are the vectors associated with the Lorentz group. And there are a couple of ways to get at those. The general approach that leads to four-component spinners and the Dirac matrices, I think, is coming up around age 50 or something. I'm not sure we can get to that. He doesn't. He approaches it a different way first. He tries to argue that you should build it up from veiled sinners, right? You can inside the conformal group. inside the Lorentz group, you can find two copies of SU2, right? And he uses those to characterize the different types of spin that you can have. One kind that transforms under one of those SU2s and one that transforms under the other SU2. The spinners that transform under those SU2s are called veil spinners, W-E-Y-L. And those are physical spinners. They're left-handed and right-handed spinners. So you can get them from the four-component Dirac spinners once you've built certain handedness projection operators. So you can decompose the Dirac spinner into these two parts. And we'll do that down the line. Let me mention the straightforward way to get the Dirac spinners. But not go through all that yet, because he's going to go through that later. But let me mention that method, just outline what we would do. And then I'll try and follow what he does with the two-component spinners. Okay? Question?
Well, I was going to ask...
Yeah?
Are there two kinds of spinners because there's twice as much space in the matrix? Because we're in a complex space now? Or are they coming from twice as many for a different reason?
The spin groups associated with SOPQ. Let me tell you the technique for building those. Those lead to matrices of dimension like 2 to the n over 2. You know, they're big matrices often. Let's see, that's not quite answering your question. We're skirting the edges of representation theory here. All right, the thing that is governing this is, you know, how many different ways can you write the same group? And there are a lot. All right, we've seen some examples. The one we've gone over in detail is SO3 and SU2. Those do the same thing to real three vectors. By way of answering your question, Joe, let me just talk about the Lorentz group and how we get the covering group of the Lorentz group. It's the same way we get the covering group of any orthogonal group. So I'm going to skip that method, and I'll tell you what you get for the Lorentz group, and then I'll make some observations about it, and we'll follow where that leads us. But we have SO31. And let's shadow this by SOP2, because you would use the same technique for either one. We have a metric, eta AB, equal, all right, in this case, it's minus 1, 1, 1, 1, or the opposite sign. And our author is looking at SO13 instead of SO31. It's just an overall sign on the metric. Or in general, we have a bunch of plus ones and we have a bunch of minus ones. Q of those and P of those. So that would be the general case. And what we do is we find matrices satisfying gamma A, gamma B equals twice eta AB. For either case, right? Eta is just the inverse to that matrix. Okay, now, we can find all kinds of properties of these things. These turn out to be nice objects. The gamma A must be 2 to the n over 2 by 2 to the n over 2 matrices, where n is the dimension of G plus Q. All right, that's something that is possible to prove, but, you know, we'll spend a day sometime and prove that. Now, in four dimensions, 4 over 2 is 2, 2 squared is 4. That's why the Dirac spinners are four components. Jeff, Joe, who are you?
Four,
2 to the n over 2 in four dimensions, four space-time dimensions, 4 by 4 matrices are required to satisfy this condition. All right, those 4 by 4 matrices act on a four-dimensional complex space. That's the space of spinners. Okay, then construct the commutator of those very same matrices. Let's call these sigma AB. Define sigma AB to be that. So, exercise. Compute the commutators of the sigma. Oh, let me make it easier for you. Show that this commutator is equal to some constant. I'm betting on what 4?
I think 4, yeah.
Times eta BC sigma AD minus eta AC sigma BD minus eta BD sigma AC plus eta AD sigma BC. Now, who recognizes that set of commutation relations? Wanda. Anybody else? Okay. Here's another exercise. Let Ji, Jj equal epsilon ijk, jk. Anybody recognize that? Yeah. That's the commutation. That's the Lie algebra for SO3 or SU2. They're both the same. There could be constant in front depending on how you choose the J. But, you know, this is the Lie algebra of the rotation group. Also let sigma ij be defined as epsilon ijk jk. Prove that guess what? Sigma ij sigma kl equals some constant. I'm not going to make any claim about what the constant is. Kronecker, JK, sigma IL, minus, the same formula. If I can write it, IK, sigma JL, minus delta JL, sigma IK, plus delta JK,
Okay, I find that true. Prove that. Now, what is that telling you? What's that telling you? What do we got here?
Three dimensions is a special case. Because you've got the Levy Civita tensor, you can write these things with a one-index object J. But this is the rotation algebra. This works in any dimension. And it's the same as the one you're familiar with. So, you know, I mean, who wants to work with this? I can't work with that, right? It's a lot easier. I want you to recognize the general one, because in four dimensions you need the general one, or in 10 dimensions that you want to do super string theory, you know, or 26, you need the more general formula. But it's the same content, it's just a change of variable here that will cast this rotation algebra in terms of some two-index signals. Now, here's what I want to find. Okay, based on these exercises, this procedure has led us to some matrices that satisfy the SLTQ rotation Lie algebra. Okay, so this construction gives us some generators of SLTQ, or in fact, SIMTQ. Once you go through a proof thing, the sigma AB are generators of spin PQ. And that is the covering group of SLP. So it gives it to you every time. So there's let's call this one a problem. Do the construction for SO3. All right, we pretty much did this last time. The answer is SU2. So let's think it through a little bit. Any questions before I go on here? I'll talk you through what's going to happen with this problem. Okay. The metric for SO3 is the Euclidean three-dimensional metric 1-1-1. So you want to find three matrices whose anti-commutator is twice Kronecker IJ. Anybody know some?
The Pauli.
The Pauli matrices do this.
Yeah.
So the answer for the gammas is the Pauli matrices. The Pauli matrices, this is called a Clifford algebra. And the Pauli matrices form a Clifford algebra.
Yeah,
I'm going to
say red dog.
What's that? So if you take the commutators, so here I'm telling you how to do the problem. In a minute we'll have done it, right?
I shouldn't do that.
So then you compute the commutators of these things, and actually those end up looking like the Pauli matrices again.
But you know, this will be some two-index thing over here. You know, that's the thing that's going to be sigma ij. Compute the commutators of those, and you know, they'll look familiar. And you should be able to get them in either of these forms, just depending on how you write this result. So carry it through for SO3. Okay, let me stop talking and let you guys ponder and ask questions. How are we doing? You're too quiet. Is it totally transparent or totally untransparent? Give me a clue here. Sounds like untransparent. Opaque or transparent? What do we got here? Opaque.
Okay. Orange is old for opaque.
Okay, how many opaques? All right. Good. So I want some questions. Backtrack. Let's go way back as far as we need to. Somebody give me a question. Let's elaborate what's going on here. Where's it losing? This is, you know, so far this is pure magic, right? I mean, there's no reason you should believe that this is true or expect it to be true until you do this calculation and prove that this happened. Okay, using this relationship, just, you know, okay, you don't have to find these matrices to do this problem. Right? The only thing you need to do to compute this commutator is to use the general relationship. Okay? If you know that the anti-commutator gives, you know, A to AB times the identity matrix there. Does that help? Okay, good. These are some perhaps large matrices. The commutator of two of these large matrices is going to be 0 or plus or minus 1, depending on what this is, times the identity matrix, times 2. So this is just a coefficient. This is, you know, 0 or plus or minus 2 times the identity matrix. Okay. I see heads nodding. That's a good thing. So we've answered some questions. There are more questions still. Let's keep asking.
So n is 3. What is 3 half?
Oh, I'm just going to ask about the odd. It's probably the greatest integer left. Let's see. What happens? Yeah, that'll do it. Take the greatest integer less than or equal to n over 2 here. All right. The thing that happens is, you remember gamma 5. Like, for the four-dimensional case, you have 4 of these. And you can take the product of all 4, and it gives you a thing that in the literature is always called gamma 5. For the odd-dimension cases, you can use that one as the 2n plus first. 2m plus first matrix. So the even dimensional Clifford algebras actually have what you need to do the next higher dimension. Next question. No rush. I've got all night. Go, point to something you don't quite follow. Point to something you do follow.
There are a few things up there.
Yeah, okay, pick one. Pick one of the things that's a little muddly.
Okay, well, the exercise at the bottom, just actually calculating the,
So you want to show this, right? So you want to take commutators of some of these things. Right? So this is the definition of a two-index
right? It's just two labels, right? Right. I make K run 1, 2, 3. So for JZ, right? You know, JZ. But what do we have? We have J1 is 0, 0, 0, and was it 1 minus 1 like that? Or minus that? It's plus or minus that. Right? So, suppose we have J1 here, then there's a sigma 2, 3 that's given by epsilon 2, 3, 1, J1. Well, this is just plus 1. Right, so sigma 2, 3 is the same as J1. It's just a change in the labeling, right? Here's what it's telling you, and this is something that will make sense, actually. Rotations in higher dimensions are not defined by the axis they preserve, because they preserve more than one axis. If you do a rotation in a four-dimensional space, it's a rotation of the XY plane. You know, it's going to leave Z and W unchanged. So there are two axes. You can't define a rotation by the things it leaves unchanged. You define it by the plane it rotates. So it's actually better to think of J1 as performing a rotation of the 2-3 plane. It's mixing Y and Z. It rotates the YZ plane around the x-axis. And so we're just changing the labeling. These are going to be the same matrices. And so you want to take the commutators of those. Well, you know that the commutators of those give some well-defined things. The trick is to get this big, ugly, nasty formula out of it. Now, one approach would be to let I equal 1, J equal 2, K equal 3, you know, L equal 1, and, you know, do that case. And you could go through all the cases, because there's too many cases. But what you can do instead is take the commutators of these, write down this commutator, substitute the definition, pull out the epsilon, and use the commutator of the J. That's going to give you another epsilon and a J. Well, you know how to combine a pair of epsilons into a bunch of Kronecker deltas. And you can invert, if you invert this, we have JI can be written as epsilon IJK, sigma JK, probably times a half, just to get the normal, because this epsilon with that epsilon gives a 2 times the Kronecker. So, let me start saying that again. You write sigma IJ, sigma KL, and you substitute the definition of the sigma, epsilon I, J, M, J, M, epsilon K, L, N, J, N, equals epsilon I, J, M, epsilon K, L, N, commutator J, M, J, N. Now you know what that is. It's this thing. So now we have 3 epsilons. It's getting really ugly here. You can see where all these Kronekers come from. Epsilon M, N, P, J, T, P. Okay, so we've gotten this commutator in terms of the J's, but in fact, this thing is just the definition of sigma and n. So now all you have to do is work out what this product of epsilons is, and there's this big identity for the product of a pair of epsilons. You can write a pair of S1s can always be written as an anti-symmetrized product of a bunch of Kronecker deltas. Once you do that, this will pop out. So now you see how you can actually, you know, it really happens. It turns into that. Next question.
So, like, if you have a Lie group, does it also satisfy, do you also get those Kleefer algebra as well?
For any Lie group?
Yeah.
All right, SOPQ is a Lie group.
Right.
But for other Lie groups, let's see, actually, yes, for the symplectic groups, the symplectic groups are, well, now, let's see. Now, the symplectic groups are different. I think the symplectic groups are the covering groups.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a organic representation for those. The conformal group is an orthogonal group. That's just a higher PQ.
Mm-hmm.
So you do get certain representations for the conformal group. Those are called twisters. Let me think. Unitary groups are already complex. General linear group. Let's see. Well, you can complexify it, GLNC. But I don't think you get a covering group for that. I'm not sure about the general linear. What happens there? So this is particular to the orthogonal, to the orthogonal.
Probably not. Non-zero determinant, right?
Need what?
Non-zero determinant.
Yeah.
So it's the actual group, you know. So.
Yeah. So yeah, GLN is the. For SLN, look at SLN.
SLN probably.
But the SLN, the complex special linear group, I mean, all right, and this is the next place I want to go with this. It turns out that spin 3-1 is isomorphic to SL2C, the special linear group in two complex dimensions. So what we've got here is a four-dimensional representation. So if we do this for SO31, we're going to get a four-dimensional representation. So we get Dirac spinners. We get a four-dimensional representation of the Lorentz group, four-dimensional complex representation of the Lorentz group. But if you look at Lie algebra, it's the same as the Lie algebra of SL2C. So we could write this as SL2C. For the SO31 case, so the covering group, spin 3-1 is isomorphic to SL2C. And so that's where I want to turn once I've answered everybody's questions on this. We'll look at SL2C. SL2C isn't quite the direct product of two SU2s, but the Lie algebra looks like two Lie algebras of SU2. And we can use that fact to classify the representations of the Lorentz group. So that's where we're headed. You didn't ask all that, did you?
No.
Okay. So let me back up. More questions? Another?
Not right now.
You're okay. You've got something you can go compute. You know, that'll help. Okay. These aren't terribly hard exercises. They look imposing. You know, this is, you know, look at this formula. It's not as bad as it looks. What could be to write this formula? Okay, you take the middle two indices, the BC, that goes on the metric, and then you get a sigma with the other two. All right, all the rest is just anti-symmetrizing. This is anti-symmetric on AB, this is anti-symmetric on CD. So the thing on the right has to have the same anti-symmetry. So here, All I've done is interchange CD. And between these two, all I've done is to...
Here I
interchanged AB. Here I've interchanged BC. Here I've interchanged both. So I've done a double anti-symmetrization. So take this and interchange CD. That gives me those two. So I've just imposed the anti-symmetry of these two terms to write the other three terms here. So you don't actually have to remember the whole long formula. It's just the anti-symmetrization to match this side. So the commutator of two sigmas is a sigma, and then you anti-symmetrize. Okay. All right. So we're chipping through the opacity. Can you see some light through the chinks? How about it? A resounding no. Oh, come on. Somebody sees some little bit of light through it. You gotta wonder how Clifford figured this out. Clifford was actually trying to generalize the Actonians. There are these number systems. You have the real numbers, the complex numbers are two-dimensional. So they map one-to-one onto a plane. The quaternions map one-to-one onto a four-dimensional space, and the Actonians onto an eight-dimensional space. And so it's natural to transfer 16 and 32 and, higher and higher dimensional spaces that have nice properties. Well, this 2 to the n over 2 is just that. Clifford found some very nice algebras that have matrices that are of dimension 2 to the n for some n. They are not number systems in the same sense that the quaternions or the Actonians are number systems. But he was studying properties of these various systems, over a century ago and, figured this out. It came out of some other investigation. But turns out to be very useful. Let's see. What else? All right, so the goal of this, what we really need this for, is to find out what the tensors of the Lorentz group are, what kinds of fields we want, right? We were saying that back at the beginning. So the fields that we want, okay, we're in the... That's a 3-1 case here, so there will be four matrices, gamma A, where A equals 0, 1, 2, 3. There will be four gamma matrices, and it turns out they need to be 4 over 2 is 2, so 2 to the 2 is, they need to be four-dimensional. So 4 by 4 matrices, complex. They act on some abstract four-dimensional complex space. That's the space of spinners. Those are the simplest non-trivial fields that we're going to be interested in. Those are the simplest things, other than scalars, those are the simplest things that the Lorentz group acts on. So we can have scalars, they just don't do anything under Lorentz transformations. Then we have spinners. Then we have real four vectors. Those real four vectors are going to be what? Matrices, right? In this complex space, a four vector is going to look like some subclass of complex matrices. And so it'll transform this way. Yeah, what do you bet that it's something like, XA gamma A. Probably. Yeah, I'm not sure that's right, but that's a good bet. This is a matrix, and these infinitesimal rotations can act on a matrix like that. Now, this is a Lie algebra. This is the Lie algebra of a rotation group. Right, you recognize it because you're going to do this second exercise and show that, oh, the only rotation group I really know anything about actually could be written this way. Well, so can any other rotation group be written this way. This is the Lie algebra of SOPQ. And so, PQ, where should I write this? Let's go back here. PQ. So, if G is an element of PQ, I can write G as the exponential of, I'm double counting here, but some real parameter with sigma AB. Okay, so these sigmas are going to be the infinitesimal generators of a representation of the rotation group. So we exponentiate them with parameters, and now this will be a rotation. So then what will happen is our new real 4 vector is going to be something like gx, g dagger will be our x prime. Once you figure out how to write this x. So, it's totally analogous to SU2. Is it hot in here? No? I'm hot. Or, it's not hot. Is it cold in here?
No.
Oh, it's just right.
It's just the average. Make it
hot. The board is steaming. Okay. All right, let's press on. Let's look at the isomorphism with SL2C. What I would like to show is that SL2C is the locally isomorphic to the Lorentz group. Right, and in fact, you can go on to show that it's isomorphic to the thing you get by this construction. I won't jump right into that today. But let's look at SL2C. Or let's look at the Lorentz group, and I'm going to construct this thing. So, let x be t times the identity plus x dot sigma.
This should look a little bit familiar.
Okay. If we don't have the time component to our 4 vector, so here we have t and x as some 4 vector x mu. You remember space time.
There we live.
You know, home. Okay. So I'm going to write a matrix built out of the Pauli matrices, the identity, and the components of some space-time 4 vector. What does that look like? Well, I've got a t plus z, an x minus iy, an x plus iy, and a t minus z. Notice that the determinant of x is equal to t squared minus z squared minus the conjugate x squared plus y squared is minus t squared plus x squared plus y squared plus z squared, which is minus
the invariant interval for space time.
So, totally analogous to what we did last time for SU2. We're going to construct some transformations that preserve the properties of that matrix. What properties do we have to preserve? So we did this in detail last time, so you know we're back on familiar footing here, and you know what to do. We need to preserve the determinant, because that's what makes it a Lorentz transformation. So anything that preserves the form of this matrix, that is, it has to be a linear combination of the identity and the polymatrices, and preserves the determinant, any transformation that does that is a Lorentz transformation. So how can we characterize the properties that determine that matrix? What did we do last time? Who was here last time?
We worked on deciding whether they had to be Hermitian or
Hermitian. Yeah, we showed that every traceless Hermitian matrix could be written in that form.
Right.
And now we've changed the form a little bit by adding this identity. Is it still Hermitian?
Yeah.
Is it traceless?
No.
What's a general Hermitian matrix look like? What's a Hermitian 2x2 look like? Okay, so let's take the dagger. We get alpha conjugate, beta conjugate here, mu conjugate there, nu conjugate here. Has to be equal to alpha, beta, mu, nu. So we have alpha and nu real, and we have mu equal beta conjugate.
Right.
All right, that's the most general Hermitian 2x2. Okay, so the most general Hermitian 2x2 is a real number here, a real number there, a C minus ID here, and a C plus ID there. Notice any similarities? Let A equal C plus C. B equals C minus Z, C equals X, and D equals 1. That pretty much does it. So the only invariant properties that will guarantee a matrix being able to be written as a linear combination of 1 and the polymatrices is that it be Hermitian. We don't need tracelessness anymore. That was a nasty one. This is easier than last time. Okay. So every Hermitian matrix looks like this. This is Hermitian. So we just have to find any transformation that preserves hermeticity and determinant. We want to preserve x equal x dagger and dead. Okay, well, the way to preserve hermeticity is to do an adjoint similarity transformation. Let x prime equal a x a dagger. Then x prime dagger is a dagger dagger. X dagger, A dagger, which is A, X, A dagger, which is X, prime. So, take any matrix A, take the Hermitian conjugate and sandwich X in there. What happens to the determinant? the determinant of x prime is going to be the determinant of ax a dagger, and that the determinant of a times the determinant of x times the determinant of a dagger. And the determinant of the adjoint is the conjugate of the determinant of the matrix. So this is just the determinant of a f with square times det x. Therefore, we need that a equal what? Complex. There you go. Right. Okay. However, e to the I phi doesn't do anything. Right? If I have a matrix A and replace it by e to the I phi times A, I'm multiplying by e to the minus I phi over here, it just cancels. So for every A with determinant e to the I phi, there's a B with determinant 1 that does the same transformation. So for all A with that A equals e to the I phi, there exists B with that B equal 1 such that BX B dagger equals AX A dagger. Does the same transformation. The phase just drops out in this expression. Okay. We're done, right? We've preserved the determinant. So take all, let's see. What determines C? So, pick any complex 2x2 D with det B equal 1. Then x prime equal b x b dagger is a Lorentz transformation. What group did we just describe? Complex 2x2, that's GL2C. Unit determinant, that makes it SL2C. Any complex transformation, linear group. Right? Any 2x2 matrix will do. Right? So that's an element of GL2C, the general linear group in two complex dimensions. Now, the S just means unit determinant rather than G for general. So we need that because the other transformations don't do anything anyway. And we have a representation of the Lorentz group. It can be shown, and we're not going to do it today, that these SL2C transformations are an exact one-to-one correspondence with the exponential of the sigma ABs, right? So we can get a four-dimensional representation of spin 3-1 by exponentiating those sigma ABs that we defined before. But they don't give us anything that isn't already in SLT.
So last week we were looking at very similar structures
mm-hmm.
that ended up being SU2 A and A dagger ended up having to be unitary, and that was only because of the traceless.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. The traceless condition forces it to be unitary.
But both representations are describing, no, SU2 describes SO3, and this is describing SO3-1.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Notice SU2 is a subgroup of this.
Okay.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. As the rotations are a subgroup of SO3-1.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that works. Okay, so let's find the generators. That's what the plan was, right? Generators. Hey, cool, we got groups, let's find generators. Let's see. How many degrees of freedom have we got here? No. complex. Complex unit determinant. So, how many? Okay. Yeah. Tell us why.
Because you have the determinant gives you one less. So if it was real, you start off with four, but a unit determinant makes it three. Because you can use the determinant equation to give you, but since it's complex, you do double.
Yeah, all right. So unit determinant is two constraints because it's a complex equation. So you have four complex numbers in a special linear, in a two-dimensional linear complex. 2x2. There are four complex numbers. But then there are these two constraints because the determinant has to be one. The real and imaginary part gives you two constraints. So there are 6 degrees of freedom, or there better be 6 degrees of freedom. We know that the Lorentz group is a six-dimensional group. So there has to be that number. We need to find the Lie algebra. We're going to do a little bit of stuff with the Lie algebra. You guys are too quiet today. Way too quiet this Monday.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay, is that it? Or am I skipping too much?
Day of the moon.
It's the moon? What?
Yeah, day of the moon, yeah.
Day of the moon. What do you do on the day of the moon? Evidently not group theory. The day of the moon. I haven't ever heard of it.
Yeah. The Monday day of the moon. Monday is only a day of the sun.
Oh.
Tuesday. Day of Mars, actually, in Spanish. Month. Wednesday, Dia Juanetis in Latin, day of Venus. Thursday is Jueves, Dia Jovis in Latin, day of Jupiter.
Okay.
Wednesday was day of Mercury, sorry. Friday is day of
So it should be noisier,
right?
We should all be a little loony. Okay. Infinitesimal generators. Right? We want to study the properties of this group. We're interested in characterizing the things that this group acts on. What kinds of things does this act on?
Complex
Say it again, Mark.
Complex.
Yep. I'm using Latin for real and Greek for complex numbers here. Okay, so we'd like to characterize these things. Let's see.
actually we know how to characterize the things that SU2 acts on.
Oh boy, this is going to open up a can of worms. All right, let's launch ourselves into this. What are the representations of SU2? What object can SU2 act on? Now, one way to say it is all ranks of tensors. So you've got some kind A where, you know, A equals 1 or 2, some little two-dimensional complex vectors. SU2 can act on that space of vectors. Then you've got matrices with two indices. You've got, things with three indices, and so on. So we have rank n tensors. And each index gets a copy of your SU2, your element of SU2. Remember, the elements of SU2 are exponentials I phi over 2 m dot sigma. Pauli matrices are the generators. So this is a matrix. You put one copy of that matrix on each index, and you know how all these objects transform. They all transform linearly, they all transform homogeneously. So that's one way to think of all of the things that SU2 can act on, but that's not the way we do it. We do it using the equivalent of spherical harmonics. All right. We do it by the value of the spin. Right? A better way is to classify each state by a value of the total length of the vector and the z component. All right, the z component of spin. And each of these things as m takes on 2j plus 1 values, m takes on 2j plus 1 values. So this is a 2j plus 1 dimensional vector. So instead of writing matrices and cubic arrays of numbers and four-dimensional arrays of 2 by 2 by 2 by 2 arrays of complex numbers, we write bigger and bigger vectors. These span the same space as those. I know I've showed you this example before. If you take a matrix, take a real 3x3 matrix, you can divide it into a trace, an anti-symmetric part, and a traceless symmetric part. One of those has one degree of freedom, the anti-symmetric part has 3 degrees of freedom, and the traceless symmetric part has 5 degrees of freedom. 2j plus 1 for j equals 0, 1, and 2. Alright? Each of those parts transforms into the same part under a rotation. So you can think of each of those three parts of a matrix as being a one-dimensional vector, or a three-dimensional vector, or a five-dimensional vector. That's what you're doing when you write these JM states. These span the same space as those, but these are all vectors labeled by two integers. Or if we're talking about SU2, J can be half integer. So 2J plus 1 takes on every integer value. So you have exactly one of these vectors for each integer. So if j is a half, you get 2 here. If j is 1, you get 3. If j is three halves, you get four, and so on, every integer. So the set of all representations of SU2, that is, all objects on which SU2 can act, can be given as a list of vectors, one vector of each possible dimension. A very succinct way to represent it. And if you transform these things, you're mixing up things of different spin. You know, all of the components of this scheme that mixes all of the components, and in fact, the anti-symmetric ones always go into the anti-symmetric ones. So you're actually telling yourself more about how the group is going to act if you look at these guys rather than those. So that's what we want to do. Right? That's an aside about SU2. We want to do the same sort of thing for SL2C. What we're going to find we can do is label all of the things that SL2C can act on. We could do this again, but instead we're going to do something like that. But there are more transformations here. And in fact, this is just big enough to contain two copies of the SU2 algebra. It's not SU2 cross SU2. The group, it's not a product group, but the Lie algebra contains two commuting sets of SU2 generators. And we can use those to label all of the spinners. Don't worry, this won't be a bit simpler when you read the book.
When we get the book,
but it'll be another pass, and it'll be a little more familiar. Let's find those generators, and let's see where those two SU2s happen. Or it's time to... It's 4 o'clock. You guys are tired. It's loony day. Maybe we could call it a day. So we'll look at the generators, or for an exercise for Wednesday, find the generators of SL2C. You know how to do that. Infinitesimal generators, you look at the... It's a linear group, so pretty much anything is a generator. It's really easy. The trick, though, is to... you can take the generators to be the polymatrices and I times the polymatrices. That's a very convenient set of six to choose. So we'll look at that next time. It's fair. We're out of time. Let's say. I'll stay and answer questions, though, if you've done it. We should be here till midnight. I saw that. There are transformations, there's a subset of transformations that preserve the direction of time. And then there's another whole copy of the connected part of the Lorentz group compounded with a time reversal operator. So the thing you want to be thinking about are the discrete symmetries.
Okay.
Remember with rotation, say SO3. SO3 is made up of two identical disconnected manifolds. Right? O3 has two copies of SO3. One, you know, there's SO3, and then there's another copy where you take every element of SO3 and you apply the parity operator. You invert every vector. You know, it's basically minus one times every element of SO3. And so you can have the you could think of SO3 as the proper orthogonal group because it preserves the handedness of space. Right? You're not inverting, you're not doing any inversion, so you're always keeping your coordinate system right-handed. Okay, now let's go up a dimension to space-time. It turns out there are two discrete transformations. You still have parity, so you still have the handedness of space, X, Y, and Z, but you also have the direction of time. You have a time reversal as a discrete transformation. So there are two discrete transformations, so there are four copies of SO31. So in O31, you have four copies of SO31. Right? You've got SO31 that preserves the direction of time and preserves the handedness of the coordinate system. That's called the proper orthochronous orthochronos, you know, preserving the time direction. So the proper orthochronous Lorentz group is SO31. Then for each element of that, you can flip the parity, you can flip the time, or you can flip both. That, so you end up with four copies of SO31.
Okay. If the parity is not right, what is it called? So proper and what is there an
improper? Yeah, you end up with left-handed product. Nobody ever uses it. You always just talk about the proper orthogonous Lorentz group. So and then you treat the discrete one as separate transformation. So you can do the discrete symmetry.
Right.
And sometimes an interaction will be preserved by those and sometimes not, and that's interesting to know.
Right.
So, for example, electromagnetism and the strong interaction preserve parity. They preserve the handedness of things. The weak interaction does not.
Right. It's like TP and CPT.
And then when you're in the SL2C representation, you also have, they're complex, so you can take a complex conjugate, and that ends up being called charge conjugation, because that's what it ends up doing.
Okay.
It'll flip the sign of the charges. So, CPT, charge conjugation, parity, and time reversal. And those are very useful discrete symmetries, but we handle them separately as discrete symmetries, and then we talk about the proper orthogonal. Sure.
Okay.
Good.
See you later. Have a good evening, everyone.
See you, Neil.
See you.
See you, Juan. I just pace here till everybody leaves or asks questions. I have a feeling there are some questions still coming.
Question.
On the next, yeah.
So are we expanding out this on these sigmas? Is that what we're doing? We're taking these two. Okay, I see what we're doing. We're taking these two and we're expanding again into that.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Good.
Monday.
Makes more sense to see it again.
Well, yeah. I mean, clearly this is a little boggling the first time around.